gentlemen, back today. Look, we've got somebody I'm excited to talk with. We've got the Don Quixote of fish biologists. We've got none other than Dave Cannon, all the way from Alaska, Aniak, Alaska. Where are you at?
Well, we're about 300 miles due west of Anchorage. Can't drive here. You have to fly.
You have to fly in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did you how did you get out there? What drove you to Alaska? Are you from Alaska?
No. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and then in my early 20s, moved to Wyoming. I was working for the U.S. Forest Service, and eventually I moved to Idaho for a little while, but back to Jackson and Pinedale, Wyoming, near Yellowstone National Park. And I actually had a lot of friends that either lived up in Alaska, Forest Service type people, or friends that had visited. But one time there was a very prominent photographer, Glenn Ketchum, who gave a presentation in Jackson, Wyoming at the National Wildlife Art Museum. I was working at the Jackson National Fish Hatchery at the time. And it just so happened that right after his presentation, which was amazing because the guy is a phenomenal photographer, I see where there was a job opened up in Bethel, Alaska for the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. And I put in for it and got it. And so it was 1998, I moved to Bethel, which is downriver about 100 miles, and worked there for 4 years. Without getting into it in great detail, there was some dysfunction going on. And dysfunction is going to be probably a topic that's going to come up on the two here today. Okay. So anyway, I left that and moved upriver 130 river miles to Aniak, where I'm at now. And I work for a Native organization. Actually, I've worked for several Native organizations since I've been up here.
So have you sworn off civilization? When was the first moment you can remember understanding that nature was important to you?
Well, always as a kid. In fact, as a small kid, luckily my parents, when I was young, we camped out with a bunch of church friends at this campground just not far, 20 miles from my home in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, in the city. But I'd go out and catch snakes. I'd fish with a little birch stick. I mean, I was probably 6 years old at the time. And birch stick with the braided line and just a hook and bread, you know, crumbled bread on there. And I'd catch bluegill after bluegill. And that's where I started. But then I luckily in scouts, my dad was a scout master. I was an Eagle Scout and a counselor. I worked at a Boy Scout camp for numerous years, hiking merit badge, nature merit badge, fishing on and on. And that's all just kind of culminated to where in my early 20s, I said, I'm moving to Wyoming. And I did. And the rest is history, as they say.
But you also got this feeling that I've seen some of your work and stuff. You're talking about the modern world is just going to hell, right? And the people are it's too fast paced, you said.
Yeah, the fast pace of life. And, you know, I guess I'm surprised at how many people don't realize it. But and I only realized it. And we have to jump to Elk City, Idaho, back when I became a fish biologist in my mid-30s and left Wyoming and eventually went to Idaho and dealt with endangered salmon and steelhead, threatened and endangered. And there was, combat biology, death threats biologists often receive.
What happens? But, like, they don't want you telling fishermen that you can't. They can't fish there, and so they.
Well, not fishermen as much. It was ranchers with cattle that were causing some problems on the stream, habitat problems. Miners, gold mining in Idaho, where I particularly lived historically, entire streams were dredged. Okay, so basically, the salmon habitat was just wasted, and logging roads would. Sediment ended up in the streams, choking spawning gravels and things like that. There was lots of animosity amongst or towards fish biologists, even from people within the Forest Service. The listing of an animal, I don't know if you're familiar with the spotted owl, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, that was hugely controversial. And but the fish, when that was listed years later, kind of made the spotted owl issue look like a walk in the park. Yeah. Because, you know, there was such a vast area, and the salmon really were hurting on the Columbia River system, but California, you name it.
Slightly more delicious than an owl, for sure.
Yeah, and anyway, so then here I am shortly after the salmon were listed, and the first listing in Idaho was 1991, and I moved there in 93. Well, you want to talk about fish biologists scrambling, trying to protect, you know, some of the few remaining wild fish. And in such a big area, it was overwhelming. And that's where I realized about the fast pace of life. In my office, and it was a remote office in Idaho, at the end of the road, you had to turn around and go back out. But not only, you know, the person in this cubicle had no idea what the person in the next cubicle was doing, but if it was a fish biologist, there was a good chance they were pissed at the fish biologist, because they were trying to save the fish from so many of these other impacts.
Right.
And everybody was running around like a chicken with their head cut off. And, you know, I used to say at one time, not only did the right hand not know what the left hand was doing, at that time, the right index finger didn't know what the right middle finger was doing.
Right.
It's just crazy. And then, you know, the politics, you know, here were a bunch of fish biologists, high-powered biologists in, you know, D.C. At all levels, and down at the smaller level where I was, you know, trying to arrest the degradation, you know, stop things from getting worse. And then you had the logging industry, lobbyists and that, you know, arguing, going to their politicians in D.C. And that's where the whole combat biology of death threats were pretty common amongst several of my peers.
You were talking about how who's a real famous rich guy, Ted Turner. His son is a fish biologist. Now, is he one of the good guys?
Or? Yeah. Well, you know, that's an interesting story, okay? And it might seem like I'm off into the weeds, but that's the story of my life. Ted Turner, you brought him up. Okay, here I am in my 30s, and I'm going back to the University of Wyoming to be a fish biologist. And I happen to get elected as the president of the student chapter of the American Fisheries Society, okay? And the American Fisheries Society is the professional society of fish biologists. And they had their one meeting, their Western Division meeting in Bozeman, Montana. So here I am in my 30s, and I'm going to be digressing to other stories that have to do with Robert Redford in a minute. So hang on and see if you can follow this. But I go to this meeting in Bozeman, and I'm pretty excited. You know, I'm going to be a fish biologist someday. I'm just a student, but I'm in my 30s, and I'm the president of the student chapter. Well, the keynote speaker, guess who that was? Ted Turner. And so I'm sitting there blown away that, holy cow, here's Ted Turner. And then I look back and there's Jane Fonda sitting in the back. And I did not know at the time that his son was a student there in Bozeman to be a fish biologist. Wow. And that was the connection. Okay. And, but no, Ted was a fantastic guy. He's one that I've tried to get a hold of to help get my message out and get this movie made. And I've even tried to get a hold of his son, but I have been unable to convince anybody that there's a story to be told here, maybe a powerful story, but there are just two of many that I've tried to entice into helping me.
As somebody that knows the, you know, I have to also do contact people I really would like to talk to, but most of them they say no or don't answer. So don't feel bad,
yeah,
Dave.
Yeah. Ah, okay. I am going to read a quote here, okay?
Please do.
Now, I have been asking lots of people for help. And whether it was a book that I tried to write a while back, and Joe McGinnis, I don't know if that name rings a bell.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. He wrote a book about Richard Nixon, and I forget the name of that one, but it was pretty big bestseller. Now, the reason I wrote to him is he wrote a book about Alaska titled Going to Extremes, and he actually featured somebody in there that I know quite well from Bethel. And I don't have a penchant for prose. I'm definitely not a strong writer. And I was trying to reach out for some help. And I wrote to this Joe McGinnis to see if he'd help me. Now, he also wrote the book about Sarah Palin. And it was real controversial because he moved next door to Sarah when he was writing it. And she wasn't happy about that. But I figured, hey, he's written books about Alaska. This guy might be interested in helping me. And so, you know, it is hard to get a hold of some people, but I was able to get a hold of Joe. And here's what he said back in an email correspondence. Given the sorry state of publishing today, I see no possibility of getting a contract that would let me work with you on this. I regret that because I'd like to, but if I presented a proposal today for what became Going to Extremes, I wouldn't even be rejected, I'd be ignored. Likewise, a proposal for a book about fishes and the environment. Reading is on the way out. The visual image is replacing the written word as the basic unit of communication.
Wow.
Let me put it this way, and I mean no disrespect. In the current publishing environment, and it will only worsen, not improve, even I can't get a book deal. That's after 12 books, six of which were New York Times bestsellers.
Holy.
I'm rooting for you. Yeah, I'm rooting for you, but there's no way I can help you. I would advise you to apply your considerable and valuable energies elsewhere. And I wish you the best, Joe. Now, Joe has since passed away, sadly. But when he said that he would advise me to apply my considerable and valuable energies elsewhere, if a book isn't going to cut it, I think a movie, something visual. But how does a guy get a movie made without a book written or a script?
Dave, the whole thing has changed. Like the medium of communication is now, it's not even a movie. People don't have attention spans for that anymore. It's these short 60-second videos where you just, you know, talking to your phone and then publish it. And you could be famous, Dave, in an instant because you have this wealth of energy.
I've made videos dreaming they'll go viral, you know.
Oh, really?
Well, now people tell me, keep it under a minute. And my stories are so convoluted, I have a hard time doing that. I've made videos 3 minutes, and I can't get anybody to watch them. I have made them up to 45 minutes, too, you know. And I've watched the statistics on any of them. And after the first 20, 30 seconds, they drop off.
Wow, yeah. That's and human.
The attention span. Trust me, I am fully aware because I actually have attention deficit disorder. And I know how people get distracted.
Oh, my God. Well, if you got attention deficit, or maybe you're just extremely gifted in a different way. That's what I like to think about. I mean, you were talking about antidepressants in the water. Shit, do you think we're taking too much fucking medicine?
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. It is wild. Speaking of attention deficit disorder, I'm going to read a book here, okay? I'm not going to read the book. I'm just going to read the final paragraph. The final paragraph, Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Tom Hartman, does that name ring a bell?
Progressive. Yeah. Of course. I like that guy. He's got a good show.
An amazing guy. Now, this is the final paragraph in this book. And he doesn't, as far as I recall, really bring up the environment But here's his final paragraph. This may seem far afield of a discussion of ADD and its causes, but no one can travel in the world today with open eyes and fail to see an ongoing escalation of social and ecological destruction. Drastic solutions are called for. We need to change our way of living or perish. Historically, necessary transformational changes in our culture have been brought about by misfits, malcontents, and dropouts, people like Thomas Edison and Benjamin Franklin. Perhaps some of our young hunters, and those are people with ADD, who we view as having difficulty in school and with adjustment to our society, will be the ones to show us new ways into a new future. And Don Quixote, the Don Quixote of fish biologist, would be the character in that movie, and he would have attention deficit disorder, and that's exactly what he's trying to do, is kind of wake the masses up to where we have a psychological rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, you talked to, with Guy there, and there's a whole lot that needs to be fix in my mind from a psychological perspective on Homo sapiens, which means the wise ones. I didn't know if you know that, but I think that's the biggest misnomer that anyone could have ever come up with.
Yeah.
Because, all right, now I'm going to bring up a word, dysfunction. Oh. All right. Now, okay. Are you ready for this? This would be the theme of the movie, okay? Now, I don't know how it's gonna take a talented person and probably a talented team of people to work this in and not offend everybody. But here we go. I've tried to explain as succinctly as I could what this movie effort's about, you know, what the theme is. And the best I could come up with is what's called a word sentence paragraph model, WSP, word sentence paragraph. Here it is. The word is dysfunction. Okay, the sentence is, if the structures of the human mind remain unchanged, we will always end up recreating the same world, the same evils, the same dysfunction. Now, who said that? Eckhart Tolle. Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, sure.
Eckhart Tolle. Ooh, yeah. All right. Now, here we go. Here's the paragraph. Humanity is a magnificent but fragile achievement. We are an evolutionary chimera, living on intelligence steered by the demands of animal instinct. This is the reason that we are mindlessly dismantling the biosphere, and with it, our own prospects for permanent existence. What I've come to learn is that humanity's troubles are due substantially to the fact that we are a dysfunctional species. And that was none other than E.O. Wilson. If you're familiar with E.O. Wilson.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow.
He is an amazing person. And so right there, two, you know, big thinkers have acknowledged, you know, that it comes down to dysfunction. But how does one address that in a movie?
And how do you express it? I mean, how would you, if you had a moment in a documentary that was going to be filmed to, you know, the masses, what would be your little message? If you had 2 minutes.
Documentary, though.
Or whatever, you know, like a message that you would send to.
Okay.
You got 2 minutes. What would you say?
Okay, well, I've been asked, hold on 1 second there. 2 minutes was the old time elevator pitch. Do you know what Hollywood people want? A one sentence logline. Seriously, one sentence logline. Okay, now I'm going to qualify that by saying I've already mentioned, I think we were recording this when Robert Altman, I see this movie being much like a Robert Altman film, okay? And his didn't follow the standard beginning, middle, and end formats, okay? They were scattered, And that's how Altman worked. And to me, if we're going to address the chaos of the world, that's the way a nonlinear type full-length feature film, not a documentary. But here we go. Other than the one sentence log line, I'm going to try to pitch this in 2 minutes or less. You can time me. You ready?
All right, go ahead.
A biologist known to some of his colleagues as the Don Quixote of fish biologists is perversely driven to make a difference by reaching the masses in a way that gets the individual to fully contemplate their place in the environment and never see themselves or the environment the same way ever again. It's a story not unlike a Robert Altman film. The only difference is that eccentric people in this biologist story are real, including every zany adventure and misadventure, not to mention the impending dreadful societal consequences that mirror sci-fi movies of old if mankind doesn't mend our ways. Throughout his decades-long quest to make that difference, our biologist eventually realizes just how profound Joseph Campbell's words are. We're not on our journey to save the world, but to save ourselves. But in doing that, save the world. Ultimately, it's a story about psychology and mental illness and the need for the human race to get in charge of ourselves psychologically and realize that each and every individual in some way is part of the impending environmental quandary and the solution if mankind is to avert unimaginable, widespread ecological and social calamity.
Boom.
So less than 2 minutes?
Minute and a half. You did good. That encapsulated everything about what needs to be done and why. And,
I think so.
You know? Now you just need scary music in the background.
I've given that same pitch to some Hollywood people, and they weren't too excited about it.
Well, don't give up. We got to keep repackaging it. You know, like the great David Lynch, his films aren't linear. They don't make sense in the traditional sense. But if an entire movie from your perspective, no matter what, would have a cohesive structure, and you could paint a picture with that. It doesn't have to have a love interest and or whatever. You know what I mean? Formulaic.
It's, got to be a talented person, familiar, with structure or a nonlinear structure. But I've been searching and trying, there's a method to my madness. I've written to over 100 people, whether they're authors like Joe McGinnis, Carl Hyacin. I don't know if that name rings a bell. He has these off-the-wall novels about Florida and often have to do with fish. I contacted him because there have been times that my life reads like a Carl Hyacin novel. But I need to connect with someone, with passion for the environment, the knowledge of, hey, something different has to make a difference. And listen and eventually help craft, whether it's a treatment or even a screenplay eventually. But I have some connections to some very interesting people, an indirect connection to Leonardo DiCaprio. I hope to get something in the hands of the person that I know that he can then pass on to Leonardo and other people. Tom Steyer, the billionaire environmentalist, I ran into a connection of his. But I've been trying for 7 years to come up with a treatment, something concrete.
Well, everybody that's listening, look, Dave Cannon is trying to get his stuff out there. So anybody, put a call in, all you movie stars that watch my program, get out there, start busting an ass for Dave Cannon. Let's try to make a movie, a simple movie. It doesn't have to be a billion-dollar blockbuster, but it can give us a few million. We'll make a movie.
Well, here's the plot of this movie that I envision it. It is this biologist who lives in the middle of nowhere, who does go by the name of the Don Quixote fish biologist, but he eventually entices a producer-director. Now, maybe the guy's down and out on his luck. I don't know what his story is, but nonetheless, he agrees to come up and spend a week in remote Alaska Now, part of that time, they sit by a campfire and the biologist flashes back to some of these zany, crazy stories. But some of those zany, crazy stories actually happen to both of them while they're here, say, in the village, you know, before they head out to their little campfire. And but it's going to take, in that biologist's eyes, someone to spend, you know, quality time, several days up to a week with him, to hear all these convoluted stories, to then understand what his story is all about. Okay, it's going to be stories within stories. But here's the final scene, and you have to maybe envision this little village, you know, in a little rinky-dink terminal. And they spent, you know, a week together, and as the biologist is bidding farewell to the producer-director, again, of the little ramshackle terminal, you know, and the biologist sheepishly says to this producer-director, "You think there's a story to be told here?" And the director, producer, he goes, "Well, no, I think there's more than one story to be told." Boom, off he goes. And that story was told during that movie, but there might need to be future movies taking a critical and irreverent look at Homo sapiens, the wise one, because who knows what things are going to be like down the road, you know, environmental-wise. There's, I don't know if you've ever heard of the term meta-crisis. Wow. Climate change is only one subset of the many crises that make up the bigger meta-crisis. And wow, there's some stuff there, some very brilliant people. Jonathan Rowson is one person's name. If you ever want to read something interesting, Tasting the Pickle.
Jonathan Rowson.
Yep. Yeah. I'll read you a real quick excerpt from Tasting the Pickle here. He says, and this is Jonathan Rowson, "There is a process of reckoning going on around the world, heightened by the conditions of the pandemic and the palpability of our fragility, inequality, and interdependence. There is a climate emergency that requires urgent action, but the precise nature, cost, location, and responsibility of that action is moot. There is a broader crisis of civilizational purpose that appears to necessitate political and economic transformation. And there are deeper socio-emotional, educational, epistemic, and spiritual features of our predicament that manifests as many flavors of meta-crisis. The lack of meaningful goal collective we, widespread learning needs, self-subverting political logics, and disenchanted worldviews. These different features of our world are obscured by their entanglement with each other." Wow, how big and complex is all of that? And the conundrum that Don Quixote, a fish biologist, has, how do you encapsulate all of this stuff into an entertaining movie, full-length feature film, that just gets people thinking differently?
And what are the other messages? Obviously, you know a lot about the problems with the pollution in fish and stuff like this. Microplastics are on your radar?
Absolutely. Bycatch. I don't know if you know what bycatch is, you know, these huge ocean trawlers, you know, they're fishing for pollock or whatever, and they incidentally catch other species and waste millions upon millions of pounds of this bycatch. And it's just crazy that, you know, when I became a fish biologist, I realized that we humans kind of generally treat aquatic species, cold-blooded, slimy, different than terrestrial species, you know, warm-blooded with eyelashes, you know, little Bambi stuff.
Something with fur.
Nowhere could you go out there, you know, hunters and shoot like two or three animals and just bring one home. That'd be wanton waste, you know, by law here. But yet, we do that very thing with fish. And it's just astounding how much is just thrown overboard as bycatch. I mean, we're talking millions upon millions of pounds in the oceans throughout the world. Happens in Alaska. That's just one issue that a conundrum that, you know, I don't know if we'll ever resolve.
Yeah.
But so many environmental crises, you know, loss of biological diversity. Ooh, that's a whole nother one.
Sure.
And me as a biologist, and I have experienced depression over the loss of so many of the things I care about. And there's a term called solastalgia that if people aren't familiar with it now, they're going to be, because it's basically environmental grief, loss of home, whether it's your actual immediate home from fires in Hawaii or floods or the environmental home. There's so many issues out there, and you know, I realize as a biologist that we're never going to stop the trend of the loss of biological diversity. It's just humans. You know, we've got, you know, 8 billion people on this planet, and there's just so many pressures, and we can do our best to lessen them, but things are inevitable. And I know I have a message that a lot of my friends don't want to really hear. That's why a full-length feature film with some humor, because Oscar Wilde said, you're going to tell people the truth, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. That's all something else I'm trying to incorporate into this film, because to be honest with you, you know, I have friends that some of them think I'm a pessimist. I got to be honest with you.
Well, fuck them.
I might be the world's biggest optimist to think that I can make a difference somehow, somewhere, especially through a film based off my crazy, quirky life.
Well, look, I don't. You're not. I'm with you. Look, I don't think things are good. I think things are bad. I think things are more. We're more than fucked. Like we're getting fucked in more from more angles than just one or two.
Nope.
Like we are getting multi fucked, and the end result is not going to be good. Ultimately, like Guy McPherson said, he said, "Look, it's a heat engine, and it's going to consume everything in its path until everything is gone." And that's it. I mean, what do you know about the overfishing up there? Because this is one of the biggest problems in the area where you are, is people, why don't they, fishermen who know that if they overfish, they'll be out of a job the next year, why do they continue to fish?
Well, human nature. And I wish I had another book here, but there was a researcher from Harvard who looked at fisheries management, and he said something to the effect of, you know, you don't have to look any further than fisheries management to find so many examples of good people, you know, making bad decisions. Now, whether it's actual managers or fishermen, but fish issues, they're so complex. There's usually not one, you know, cause of declines. I lived in Idaho. We had the dams on the Columbia were a big major problem, but there was over fishing. There was habitat loss, like I said, grazing issues, mining issues, logging issues. And as a biologist, that's where, you know, I realized there's so many wicked problems out there that maybe don't have any solutions, because we're dealing with humans and human nature. But, you know, in Alaska right now, where I live, our salmon aren't doing well. Now, is it from overfishing? Not really. The climate change, I believe, and many others do, changing conditions out in the ocean and possibly fresh water. But people here who live off the land, pretty much, aren't able at times to fish for these salmon. And there's just so many complex issues. Getting back maybe to tasting the pickle and metacrisis, you know, human nature being what it is. Yeah, I don't know if we're ever going to really work through we need a collective psychological rehabilitation. And I don't know if that's possible. It's a dream.
I mean, you grew up in civilization, but then moved slowly out of civilization. What was it about, what are we doing wrong in the modern world, in your opinion? What are all the things that we're doing wrong?
Well, I think the biggest thing is we aren't living within the means of natural systems. You know, the whole consumerism thing. Yeah, there's so many issues. But here's an example, and controversial. And is there a solution? I don't know. Farm-raised fish. You know, I would like to think that we could have sustainable wild fisheries. But you've got, you know, farm-raised fish out in the oceans. There's concerns there with disease and so many issues. But yet, there's people believe that we, you know, aren't going to be able to feed, you know, the all these people on our planet with just wild fisheries. So we need to somehow genetically engineer and. I'm just a generalist, and I just see us humans as, I don't know how to really explain it. We are shitting in our nest in a big way.
Pissing in the well. Do you think that we're overpopulated?
Well, you know, maybe, but maybe not. If the average person were willing to live within the means of the system and know the difference between wants and a need, I think we probably could, you know, support this many people. But you just look at lavish lifestyles and greed and on, and I just don't see things turning around.
There's also agricultural implications. Like you're talking about nitrogen runoff and chemical runoff and stuff. Does that play into
it? Well, it does. Now, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and the Chesapeake Bay is a classic example. And Pennsylvania, all those farms, nitrogen and that gets into the Chesapeake Bay. That thing at one time was just a phenomenal ecosystem. Oysters and all kinds of fish. Where I grew up, historically, shad used to make their way up through Pennsylvania into New York. Well, that didn't happen since coal mines and then diversion dams and on. But the whole Chesapeake Bay, you know, is nowhere near it should be from productivity standpoint. And yeah, there you go. You know, you got all these dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. The Mississippi, huge, you know, dead zone down there. And, you know, it doesn't seem like we're really able to find solutions to those problems.
This is why I drink, Dave.
Well, yeah, I should maybe go out to the cabinet up there, but I'm drinking water for now, right out of the river.
Well, you're lucky that you can still drink water from nearby. So well, let me ask you this. What have you heard as far as toxic pollutants in most waterways? What are we talking about?
Well, yeah, you know, the pharmaceuticals, all kinds of things.
Holy smoke.
In bigger systems, you know, down in the lower 48, antidepressants in the waters. And,
wow.
You know, sexes of fishes is changing. It's just when I grew up in Pennsylvania, I don't know how many lakes and streams had advisories, a good portion of them, that pregnant women, you know, shouldn't eat fish caught in them. Or even if you're not pregnant, you know, shouldn't eat more than so many meals, you know, a month of the fish. And it was things like that that I actually was trying to get away from that made me, you know, move out west and then eventually up here to Alaska. And but we're not without our issues up here in some places. We actually have a village or two that during heavy rains does possibly dump some sewage into the river.
What?
And yet there are. Oh, yeah. It's not a common thing, but it does happen on occasion.
Why would somebody do that?
Well, not intentionally. It's just the way things are designed out here, harsh conditions. Okay. Inadequate, facilities. Okay. And things are very expensive to fix up here or do right to begin with.
Right, right.
So they're just, mankind's footprint. you can't go hardly anywhere and not, mercury in the atmosphere, acid deposition and things like that. I made a real short video here the other day. I was up in the middle of nowhere, I thought. And first of all, trying to make videos, and I've made lots of them that haven't gone anywhere, but you can hear jets going overhead, and they're going to Asia, who knows where they're going. But son of a bitch, I went up this little stream and I found one of those little dental floss pick things.
Oh my
right
God.
There in the water. Yeah, it was like, holy shit,
what
where'd this come from?
What the fuck is wrong with these people?
I know. Amazing. I'll send you the link for that video. That's one that
it's bad if it has like Chinese writing or Russian writing on it. You're like, this came from a far way too.
Again, the human footprint down at the bottom of Mariana Trench. I don't know, was it a spam can or something that they found? But there's junk all over the place.
Yeah. This is the tragedy of our lifetime, and that we have to live through it to understand just exactly what we've done and why we've done it.
I'm going to recite two quotes from a guy by the name of Aldo Leopold, father of conservation. And one of them was that really resonated with me shortly after I went back to be a fish biologist. We biologists live in our own world of wounds. And boy, I, get wounded every day. But here, this one was in his final essay titled An Ecological Conscience. And he expressed in that his frustration over the futility of trying to improve the face of the land without improving ourselves. And that gets back to that whole psychological component. And speaking of which, now here's a book that people might want to read. Sally Weintraub's The Psychological Roots of Climate Crisis. So there's back when I was finishing up my college there in my mid-30s, I worked at the fish hatchery at the Jackson National Fish Hatchery in Jacksonville, Wyoming. And I remember I was cleaning run of the raceways there. And somebody said, now, Dave, you got your degree, and it's just an undergraduate degree. And they said, maybe you should go back, to college and for a master's. And I thought, I don't think that's really in the cards. Here it is. I'm already in my mid-30s. But I said, if I do, I'm probably going to take psychology classes, to find out why is it that people do what they do and keep doing, what they do. But interestingly enough, since that time, there's been two relatively new up-and-coming fields, conservation psychology and environmental psychology, okay? And then that's exactly what they're trying to do. And now even psychiatrists are getting involved. There is the Climate Psychiatry Alliance. And I was actually interviewed by a psychiatrist here a couple of weeks ago for his podcast. And there's a huge, huge effort, thank goodness, from the psychological side of things, trying to either figure out why we humans do what we do or help the people who are suffering or will suffer from that soul nostalgia.
Right. Yeah.
It's shit hits the fan. Now, I can't say I agree with Guy McPherson, that by 2030, we're not going to be around.
It's very, pretty who knows generous. It's pretty generous prediction.
But I do know there are going to be a lot of people suffering, from environmental grief. And here's how my movie, I believe, is going to help. Because I experienced severe depression over the loss of those fishes back when I lived in Elk City, Idaho, shortly after the salmon were listed. as threatened or endangered. And I really hit rock bottom, and there's a lot to that. But I learned, you know, basically the serenity prayer to accept the, grant me the serenity to accept those things I can't change, courage to change those that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. But, I mean, trust me, I was a basket case. And our protagonist is going to have to go through that in this film and come out the other side a better person, much like Joseph Campbell's quote. You know, we're not on this in this world to save the world, but to save ourselves, and in doing that, to save the world. Because something's going to have to kind of let people know, first of all, what the reality is, and then how can they cope with that reality as things only do get worse.
Yeah. And how do you, I mean, what do you have any tricks or what do you do when you get that kind of existential dread?
Well, you know, it just what I've gone through earlier, and I've told myself I'll never let myself get to that point again. I am still on antidepressants, a real mild one. Maybe that helps. I don't know. A big reason I actually wanted to get on antidepressants was to help my writing. You know, I had a hard time writing. Something that people would want to read. And hopefully it gives me a little clearer thinking process.
Has it helped?
I think so.
Yeah. They do work, that's for sure. There's one thing that's for sure. Yeah. They'll make you feel better.
Yeah, they're not for everybody, I guess. And it'd be nice if, you know, we could do things that we don't need to be on those antidepressants. But I don't know. I think the way things are, I'm trying to be a realist. And there's a very interesting NPR clip, and it's a psychologist from Australia, I think, where he says that in the old days, we thought people who were depressed didn't have a good grasp of reality. But he said, no, it's flipped. He said, you know, it's the people who, you know, are oblivious to what's going on who don't have a real grasp of reality. And folks who are depressed do understand for the most part.
All too well.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're a dog guy, right? You got some dogs around there?
Well, I used to. Sadly, he passed away. And since I'm a wildlife photographer, I haven't got another one. You know, the dogs often either keep animals away
That's true. I can never get, when I'm out with my, I cannot get close and personal with any other animal. It's just
right.
But
well, and here's another part of that, though. I had to, because living here in Bush, Alaska, we don't have veterinarians. I had to dispatch my own dog, and that was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I don't think I ever want to do that again. So, you know, there's a whole other reason why I haven't got another one. He was a good companion.
Was it over the time?
Yeah. He lived to be 15. His last walk, I didn't realize it was going to be his last walk, but it was, and it was time.
Yeah. Well, more natural than anything else. Let me tell you something. I'm going to tell you a really sad story.
It wasn't natural.
But most, I heard this quote from this vet, and he said, most dogs die alone because the people, city people, you know, people in the lower 48, they take the thing to the vet and just let him go because they don't want to be in the room. And the vet said the saddest thing in the world was that dog looking around, looking for its people at that last moment for some kind of, you know, where's my people? Where's my...
Well, now I would have probably moved to Alaska sooner had I not had a black lab that ended up 15 years old also. And about the time I really thought I might move to Alaska, he was pushing like 12. And I'm thinking, well, you know, he's getting up there and who knows what kind of a job I'll have where I have to run and have somebody, you know, watch him. There's a lot of responsibility. So I always said, well, I'm going to wait till he goes before I moved to Alaska. And he was a special dog, but it came time to call the vet, and the vet came to the Jackson National Fish Hatchery, and there he was in my lap when he gave him the injection there. And so that was a tough time, but yeah. He's got one of the best burial sites. He's buried in Teton National Park, looking right at the Grand Teton Mountains. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a friend at an in-holding, and that's where I buried him.
Most biological life doesn't do as good. You know, most biological just suffers the whole time through. Humans and dogs, we got it pretty easy, so we can be happy when our life is over and just say, all right, fuck it, you know? But it's hard. But, well, you know, we'll leave it for next time. We'll get into some more sadder topics. Before we go, what else should we be talking about, Dave? What's on your mind?
Well, I just need help in bringing this vision of mine somehow to fruition. I mean, I eat, drink, and sleep trying to get a message out. Literally, it consumes me. I think some of my friends here are worried about me, but it's something I'm driven to do. And yeah, we can talk at the next discussion on what maybe why that is.
Yeah,
like something has to up, you know, the average person.
Yeah, to wake them up.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Where can people find you if they want to get in touch with you?
Well, yeah. Life's complexities. I have a website at this point in time, but I'm not a website guy. It's going to have to cease come the end of this year because of. Something's outdated, and you can look up Cannon's Pesco Creations, and I do have pictures on there. I do have some musings and some video clips, but Cannon's Pesco Creations, yeah, and then I'm going to have to find a new probably website in the January.
Well, you set it up. I'll build it if you need it. Any kind of work you need done, I'll you know, spruce it up.
Oh, all right. That sounds good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I have one taker who's she builds them, and she's a friend of mine here in Antioch. She just was out here this summer, and she loves it here. So I'll talk to her first, but you'll be second right. In line there, or
good to
maybe
know.
You can work together.
There you go.
I just would love help and know that. One person. None of us are as smart as all of us. So
right,
it's going to
exactly.
Take a team effort.
We're stronger together. I'm in your corner. So whatever you need, Dave, we really appreciate you, everything that you're doing and that you're getting the message out there and that we're all in this together. We're on this sinking ship. We got a chance. We got a fighting chance.
Yeah. And
you know, but we got to wake the people up, Dave.
Yep. Check out Tasting the Pickle there.
Jonathan Rousen.
Jonathan Rousen, yeah.
Okay. Sounds like an interesting read. All right, well, let's sign off to everybody in TG Land.
One you may want on your
podcast. Oh, really?
Podcast,
yeah, let me write that down.
Absolutely. The guy is just brilliant.
Well, let's sign off to everybody in TV Land. We'll keep talking after this.
Yep. Sounds good.
Thanks for coming, everybody. We'll see you next time. Be sure to check out all the links in the description. Check out Dave. He's going to come back. He's going to do it again because he is a lot of fun. Wonderful human being. Thanks for coming, Dave. Dave Cannon.
Thank you.